Abiy Ahmed has accomplished a lot here. He has not just managed to put himself in power, he has managed to significantly cut down people that used to run the country militarily. He has fundamentally shifted the way that politics work in Ethiopia.
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I'm Murray McElhone, in charge of everything podcasty. And joining me is Robert Morris, in charge of everything politically.
I like that. How's it going, Murray?
Yeah, things are going well. Weather's slowly getting better. Not so frosty, but still quite windy. How are you getting on?
I'm just kind of amused. Have you seen the movie The Beekeeper?
No. Is it a recent film?
It is strange. So it's a Jason Statham action film. And okay. I have sort of a unique taste in films that I think could be described as terrible, frankly. If things are blowing up and Jason Statham's in it, I'll probably go watch it. I went and watched this, and it's kind of fascinating because I don't think The Joker was a good film, but I think it was a much higher quality film than The Beekeeper. I got the similar feeling walking out of The Beekeeper, which is just like the fact that this is sort of a mass market entertainment is a indication that all is not well with the United States of America. So The Beekeeper, it is a standard action shoot 'em up dynamic, but the way that it is, the villains are telemarketers.
Oh.
The villains are basically just essentially big tech companies taking advantage of grandma.
A realistic enemy.
Well, that's the thing. And as the film goes on, I don't want to give it away. You know, he goes up the hierarchy of.
Oh, so he just works in the company?
No, he kills everybody. He just blows things up. He blows things up.
I thought he was going to work in the company until he was at the top and then just go rampage.
No, this is an action film, not a HBO prestige TV series. No. It's really quite straightforward. He is taken care of by a lovely grandma figure from The Cosby Show, actually, which was an interesting. And she is betrayed and kills herself because everything is stolen from her telemarketer.
So it's a bit like the puppy in John Wick.
Actually, yes. That was a reference. I've heard that reference in other contexts. So he very quickly moves on to blowing up a call center, and then he traces it to a tech company, and then he traces it to high-placed American political figures. And it's just an indicator of the bad guys aren't terrorists, the bad guys aren't the Russians, the bad guys are the machinery of U.S. capitalism. I think it's just really telling. I remember watching The Joker and making a video about The Joker being like, this is an indicator that U.S. culture is not happy. And we saw actually within a year of that film coming out, massive riots in the streets. You know, just this, the fact that it's honestly a little bit hopeful, the fact that people are actually going to big budget action films that talk about the real problem. Not that I believe that all tech companies or U.S. politicians should be savagely murdered. That is not what I'm saying here.
Savagely debated.
Savagely debated and perhaps to some degree expropriated. But it was just a really fascinating dynamic to see that this is like a mass market action film, and it's just another indicator of just how unhappy people are. Seems to be doing okay, and even by the standards of its genre, it's not a particularly good film. It is a fun exploding death vehicle, if that's what you're into, which is what I'm into.
Would you like to talk about another terrifying exploding death vehicle?
Woof, that is not the way that I like to refer to the country of Ethiopia or its leader, Abiy Ahmed, but that is certainly a way that you could refer to Ethiopian Prime Minister, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Abiy Ahmed.
But I think I won a Nobel Peace Prize. Didn't everyone in the EU win one once? So.
Quite possibly.
So, you know, they're common. They get around.
Yeah. They're straightforward. So I think that I was honestly surprised that we haven't done an episode on Ethiopia yet, because it is, first off, Ethiopia is a fascinating country, famous for being the lone holdout, the one country that, with the exception of like a four-year interval, was never colonized by European powers.
But sadly, it felt like it made up for it afterwards.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it is a huge country that has had a tremendously difficult experience. It's a tremendously difficult place to govern.
11 ethnic regions and over 80 ethnic groups.
Yes. But it is also a sizable country. And since...
Yeah, I think it's second largest in Africa, population-wise.
After Nigeria, I'd imagine, yeah. So it's 120 million. I was always saying 110, but it's apparently 120 million. It departs from the narrative of sort of African weakness in a lot of... It's a bad narrative anyway, but in a lot of important ways, maintaining its independence with the exception of a few years during World War II or in the run-up to World War II and during World War II. And the fact that it doesn't have as much of a colonial legacy as much of the other places do, and that it really does have groups of people that have fiercely maintained their independence and fiercely fought each other for centuries. I did a very long video that I'm quite proud of a couple of years back on sort of the genesis and of Ethiopian civil war, what have you, and talking about Ethiopia and how it was an empire against empires. It was, I believe, or don't quote me, I think it was Amhara leaning or a mix of Amhara and Tigray leaders who managed to found an Ethiopian empire in the mid-19th century that managed to marshal enough resources to fight off every European attempt. But it was an empire itself. In a more classic sense, it was exactly that unwieldy grouping of ethnicities. And the figure of Abiy Ahmed is taking that set of ethnicities and is attempting to wield it, to mold it, to forge it into a more...
Modern?
Modern or just a more consolidated Ethiopian identity.
Because wasn't the way it ran before, it was like each ethnic group, I think of these 11 ethnic groups, all had their own representation in government. And
yes.
I think his argument is that this is sort of pointing out and creating division when we could be a united people working together. That's sort of, you know, how he would portray it.
Yes, I think that there's some merit to what he's saying and there's some merit to what he's doing. But along the way, he's also killing hundreds of thousands of people.
And could be trampling on these, you know, smaller peoples that it's been set up to protect.
So it's this dynamic where is this guy George Washington or is this guy Hitler? You know, it is, or does he have a little spice of both? And that is why I think Abiy Ahmed is a much more compelling figure and is worthy of much more attention than he's getting. The combination of Abiy Ahmed, I mean, Abiy Ahmed is not possible without the incredible potential power that Ethiopia provides and how he is managing to somehow survive and shape this country. He's now been there for 6 years. I mean, it feels like an eye blink. You know, he was new and he was a very exciting figure and very new and someone that people thought about very positively before 2020. And the more violent edges of his program became more visible. But I think there's a real pot. We are obsessed with the idea of strongmen. You know, like everybody's a potential new strongman and da 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 da. And I think Abiy Ahmed is probably the figure with the most potential among all these strongmen seriously change his region, to change borders. And what prompted us to finally talk about Abiy Ahmed today is conflict with Somalia. And the fact that he is attempting to facilitate or take advantage of, it's not entirely certain, the disintegration of Somalia to get access to a port. But that's just one of many, many things that Abiy Ahmed has been up to in his six very tumultuous years in power. And I think that's kind of what I'd like to talk about today. Abiy Ahmed specifically, Ethiopia a little more in general, because it is a fascinating, important region. I was once considered doing a video series called Bab el-Mandabia, you know, because it's, you know, Ethiopia has got a rim of countries that block it from the Bab el-Mandab. Is that a strait?
It's where there's a lot of action being going on lately.
Exactly. The Bab el-Mandab Strait is the entrance to the Red Sea, where Yemen and the Houthis are currently semi-blockading commercial traffic. So if Abiy Ahmed and Ethiopia have continued success at what he seems to be trying to do, which is assert more and more power over the Horn of Africa more broadly, because a lot of the Horn of Africa is Ethiopia, sort of in the center there, surrounded by Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti. Abiy Ahmed has the potential to be a really formative long-term player. He's also quite young. He's 47, but yeah.
But also one thing about him is he's both of a Muslim and Christian background. And is it Oman and...
Oromo, are you talking about?
Oromo and...
Amhara.
He's of both... lineages, so I feel like
I love that. We basically had, so I very confidently gave you two pronunciations that are probably wrong. So it's a couple white guys trying to talk about the ethnicities of Ethiopia, but here we are.
But I think he's sort of trying to sort of portray that, you know, my ethnicities could be, you know, a template for the country itself, that all of these religions and peoples can come together.
Well, he's fascinating figure. I believe he's got a bit of a messiah complex. That's certainly the impression that I get from some of the descriptions of him. Why wouldn't he? He's managed to be incredibly lucky. Like, his rise to power is...
And he's still alive.
Yeah, his rise to power is incredibly improbable, but seems to continue. The fact that he was able to survive the Tigray War is quite extraordinary. He's actually been quite helped by the fact that other regional powers have been in even worse shape. It'd be a lot easier to isolate and give Abiy Ahmed all kinds of trouble for the genocidal aspects of his war against the Tigrayans, who ran the country before him. But you kind of can't in the context of Sudan right next door dissolving into a horrific civil war. So we're kind of at a point where any kind of stability in the Horn of Africa has to kind of be...
praised?
Yeah, not about praised, but has to be sort of cherished to a degree. Whereas if it were a broadly peaceful region, we'd be talking about Abiy Ahmed's defense at the International Criminal Court. In the current context, it's just like, well, you know, he's someone maybe somebody can work with, or something along those lines. So to back up a little bit, Ethiopia, if you look at a map, it is the sort of heart of the Horn of Africa in West Africa.
Mm-hmm. It almost looks like a little fox's head, I always think.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. And to its great benefit, it is surrounded by very small countries. Even Somalia is, especially now that Somaliland is considering breaking off, I think Somalia nominally has 17 million people. That's a big country, but Ethiopia has 120. Djibouti is tiny. I think that's around a million. Eritrea, despite the fact that Eritrea has provided incredible obstacle to Ethiopia for decades, Eritrea is only 3.62 million people. If Abiy Ahmed's policy of forging a more united Ethiopia is successful, a more united and prosperous Ethiopia is successful, it's somewhat easy to imagine him sweeping away all objection. I think he's not going to be able to conquer Djibouti, that's for sure. Because mm-hmm. there's
oh, definitely, all... with the sheer amount of nations in it.
Well, yeah, there's a U.S. military base there. There's a Chinese military base there. I think some other countries have military bases
there. Yeah, I think there's
there.
An Italian and probably a German and French.
I think there's enough bad blood. And I don't think he'd probably be able to conquer Eritrea or Somaliland or what have you either. But the sheer ballast of the prosperity and power that Ethiopia has means that if it does get to a point where it's all pulling in one direction and it is a little less invested in its own endless conflicts, then independent or not, what Djibouti and Eritrea and Somaliland want or don't want becomes immaterial because Ethiopia is just such a juggernaut. It's perhaps, you know, it can't just roll over Sudan. And Kenya is a powerful and quite wealthy country of 53 million that does have a unified political system. Sudan is a country of 45 million that is disintegrating into a nasty civil war. So Ethiopia...
That may also then hinder itself, because a lot of very highly educated on the battlefield men might pop over and make things a little tricky.
Well, certainly, but Ethiopia has a lot of experience with that. And I think the lack of a unified state competitor is probably, to my mind, is the more important dynamic. But that's a very good point. In most of the border that it shares with Sudan is already a horrific war zone, which we'll get into. The Ethiopian territory of a horrific, very recent war zone. So as you mentioned earlier, the EPRDF, it was a coalition of militia forces that threw out the DERG, which was initially sort of a communist joint dictatorship, but ended up being really a one-man show. In the 90s, when the Soviet support of that communist dictatorship that had really horrifically mismanaged Ethiopia for a decade or so or two, you know, when the Soviet sponsorship disappeared, the EPRDF was able to take over. And that seems to have been incredibly successful, frankly. As you mentioned, it was a coalition of ethnic forces. So everybody had their own, the Oromo, the Amhara, the Tigrayans, they all had their own parties that were nominally together under this one overarching system. The problem with that system was that it was, well, the main problem with that system was that it was incredibly dependent on Meles Zenawi, who was a, I believe, Tigrayan figure of, generally acknowledged to be a figure of tremendous capacity and success. So Ethiopia in my childhood was, that's where all the starving people were. That was the sort of a watchword for state failure. Under Meles Zenawi from the early 90s up until his sadly premature death in 2011, 2012, thereabouts, Ethiopia became an incredible success story. And in part, the ability of Abiy Ahmed to be such a attempted revolutionary figure is underpinned by the prosperity that the EPRDF under Zenawi put together. It became, you know, he did a great job, Zenawi did a great job of catering to the United States, but also catering to China. 2006 to 2009, one of the frankly awful things that that government did was they, with U.S. sponsorship, they went in and destroyed Somalia, which was a really bad thing. But at the same time, Zenawi did a great job of saying, oh, we're kind of adopting the Chinese economic model, and brought like large-scale industrialization. Well, I don't know about large-scale is the right term, but significant industrialization and a great deal of prosperity to Ethiopia. Unfortunately, Zenawi, who seems to have been a miraculously talented figure, died prematurely, you know, I think in his 50s or 60s. The Ethiopian government that was nominally this very diverse, carefully put together thing seemed to have been rather rudderless, continuing to have some economically successful years, but as the legitimacy of the Ethiopian government sort of fell further and further into shreds. As I mentioned, all of the ethnicities had their own parties that, you know, functioned in this larger party structure. But the most important party had always been the TPLF, which was the party of the Tigrayans, where I believe Zenawi came from.
So they would roughly make up about 6.5% of the population, so still quite small, but that makes them about the fourth largest ethnic group in the country.
Yes, yep. And I think it is a very fair critique that of the development of the incredibly positive developments that Ethiopia was experiencing, Tigray, a small province in the corner of Ethiopia, was getting a disproportionate or even the lion's share of the benefits of this economic development. And with Zenawi, who was doing a good job of sort of managing this, that, and the other thing, things weren't spinning off the wheels as much. Things started getting worse and worse and worse across the 2010s. And I even remember using Ethiopia as an example. It's like, why are we going so crazy about, you know, Assad killing some protesters? They're killing tons of protesters in Ethiopia. It was bad, and it was getting worse. And this is sort of the context of Abiy Ahmed's rise. You'd mentioned he's I've always known him to be Oromo, but I think I wouldn't be surprised at all if he also had some Amhara.
The Oromo is 32%, and the Amhara would be about 28%. So together, they're the majority.
So the Amhara, my understanding is that the Amhara, in some combination with the Tigrayans, are the historic rulers of Ethiopia. Like, that's what the Ethiopian Empire was under Haile Selassie. And I think the Derg might have been of that extraction. I'm not entirely certain. So anyway, specifically a big threat to... Okay, so Abiy Ahmed is Oromo, has Amhara background apparently, and was fascinating to me that to get ahead in the political system that ruled Ethiopia, he also had to learn Tigrayan.
Okay, as a language, interesting.
which I think confirms a lot of what the critiques of the Tigrayans say about how Ethiopia was being run back then. In 2018, in a bid to save itself, the EPRDF, which is, I believe, just sort of a liner on the TPLF, the Tigrayan party, decided, you know what we should do? We should appoint an Oromo figurehead. And that Oromo figurehead that they chose was Abiy Ahmed. So he's initially designed to get out. Oromo, as you've mentioned, are the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia. So the EPRDF thought this would be an easy answer for satisfying, placating the largest minority. Let's put this Oromo guy in charge. What they did not reckon with was how quickly this guy was able to, I assume, leverage discontent within the governing elites to make some really rapid changes. In going back to the 1980s, the fight against the communist dictatorship was spearheaded by Tigrayans, TPLF, and the Eritreans, who are a separate country that was only established as such in the early 1990s. The Eritreans, I think, can traditionally be described as part of Ethiopia, but because they were on the coastline, I believe the Italians were actually able to colonize Eritrea and had some control over Eritrea for a number of decades. I can't remember the exact details there. When Ethiopia kicked out the Italians, they also kicked them out of Eritrea. And I think in the directly post-World War II, Eritrea, with some international guarantees around autonomy, was part of Ethiopia. And the Eritreans never really liked that. The communist dictatorship was fighting an ongoing long-term war against the Eritreans to try to keep them in Ethiopia, which they lost in 1991. At the same time, the Tigrayans were leading a internal to Ethiopia, though, you know, what the real difference between Tigray as a region and Eritrea as a region when they were both fighting against this communist dictatorship. So the Tigrayans, which remained in Ethiopia, and the Eritreans, which attained independence from Ethiopia in the 1990s, defeated the communist dictatorship. And I think more or less promptly, maybe there were a couple of years in there, but maybe not, went to war with each other. So sadly, after Eritrean independence, the Tigrayans that they had worked with against the communist dictatorship got power in Ethiopia and were like, actually, maybe you shouldn't be independent. So I believe over the 30 years between the end of the communist dictatorship and Abiy Ahmed, there were periods of greater and lesser intensity, but Ethiopia and Eritrea were just at war. And as you would imagine, for a country of 3 million at war against a country of 120 million, There was a high degree of militarization. Eritrea has become known under its under Isaias Afwerki, I'm sure I mispronounced that, has become known as the North Korea of Africa. It is a tremendously personalist, controlled dictatorship. So what happened, and I think this is a key part of Abiy Ahmed's campaign against the people who put him in power, was that in very swiftly after being put into this position, he started pursuing peace with Eritrea, which was very surprising. And this is the reason why Abiy Ahmed has won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Was that considered controversial with his, you know, party and the populace?
I would imagine it was incredibly controversial with the Tigrayans who had put him in power. Because even at that point, they had a sense that this was aimed at them. And
because the region where the Tigrayans live would border Eritrea. So it's something that's, you know, going to personally affect them, while some of the other ethnic groups, it's sort of a, yeah, it's just something happening over there.
Well, exactly. And I think, I don't know that the extent to which you can say this, but I would imagine that a lot of the motivation in the ongoing enmity between Ethiopia and Eritrea for those decades was Tigrayan, the Tigrayans who ran the country at that point. So Abiy Ahmed did that and was swiftly rewarded by the broader world community. He was given a Nobel Peace Prize. This was a big deal. This was seen as possibly, we'll get a saner Eritrea out of this. You know, we'll get broader regional peace and prosperity. This looks fantastic. And everybody was very excited. And I think that part of, and Abiy Ahmed became a bit of an international dandy. Everyone was very excited about him. And I think this gave him the power just a year and a half into his time as prime minister to dissolve the EPRDF, which is a tremendous big shift. So this umbrella party of all the ethnic parties was dissolved. Some of those ethnic parties continued. Some of those ethnic parties became part of his new supposedly non-ethnic prosperity party. But that's a pretty, I don't know enough about the details of what happened between his appointment in April 2nd, 2018 and November 2019, but that is an incredibly seismic shift in Ethiopian politics, a system that had been largely fairly successful, but had certainly spent the past decade falling apart, was dissolved by one guy who decided, we're going to do a different thing now. And he has at least once, I don't think these elections would be described as fully free or fair, but he has at least once gotten the endorsement of the Ethiopian people. In an election. It's an interesting question is, would he have gotten as much of an endorsement from the people if he hadn't participated in the horrific war that we're about to discuss? So it turns out that he did this peace deal with Eritrea. The Tigrayans hate the Eritreans, and the Eritreans really hate the Tigrayans. And it seems hard to doubt that at some point in these conversations, probably never written down, but part of the agreement between Eritrea and Abiy Ahmed as the Ethiopian government was, we're going to go against the Tigrayans together. And that's a key, really nasty aspect. I think the generalized sense of this war, that you should be more sympathetic to the Tigrayans than to the Ethiopian government, that is correct. Yes, you should. It is a minority of 6 million defending itself against a country of 114 million other people. They are the little guys. Absolutely, starvation was used as a weapon. Absolutely, there were genocidal aspects to what was done to Tigray. That is qualified somewhat when you consider just how much power they had in the country beforehand. Again, Abiy Ahmed's a bad guy. And also, I think is a minor correction to some videos I put out at the time. I do believe that Abiy Ahmed wanted this war, but I don't believe he started this war. I think the Tigrayans did start this war because they thought that they had enough control of the Ethiopian military and enough residual power to be successful at it. And to be clear, for a little bit there, it did look like they were successful at it. And because the Tigrayans ran the country for 20 years, sort of every Ethiopian that had the money and the wherewithal to go abroad and meet American diplomats, American journalists, the head of, is he still the head of the World Health Organization? I think he might be. I won't even attempt to pronounce his name, but he is an Ethiopian and a Tigrayan. So what was a bit confusing for most analysts, including this one, of that war, was that we just had a full front of every Ethiopian that any Westerner knew was a Tigrayan saying this is a horrific genocidal war. And to be clear, there were horrific genocidal aspects to this war. But I do think it is worth pointing out that this genocidal war against the former leaders of Ethiopia is probably the main reason that Abiy Ahmed was able to win an election. I'm not saying it was free or fair, but like, you know, that is probably a popular choice in a lot of the country. This horrific war, there were moments where it looked like the Tigrayans were actually going to be successful in taking Addis Ababa. I don't think I fully fell for that, but there are some that did. But it was always kind of ridiculous that a region of 6 million people was going to defeat a country of 120. And eventually the weight of numbers told. And crucially, it wasn't just Ethiopia, it was also the Eritrean military. And it was also a lot of militia, Amhara militias, who were helping this fight. That certainly lasted longer than Abiy Ahmed wanted it to, or that most analysts expected. But by November 2022, a full 2 years later, the TPLF was sort of forced to the table and conceded a number of things.
Is there much chance of Sudan getting involved in this?
Well, none. That was sort of a question in 2020. But even in 2020, the Sudanese situation was quite tense. It was in 2019 that Omar al-Bashir, Sudan's multi-decade dictator, fell from power. And in 2020, we had sort of a democratic transition that was trying to negotiate with or just hold its head above water when faced with the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF that are now fighting a nasty civil war in Sudan. So Sudan has enough of its own problems, and that was the case even back in 2020. So the Sudanese have certainly taken a lot of Tigrayan refugees, but the chance of large-scale Sudanese involvement in this aspect of the conflict is very slim, I would say.
Because there does, I've had reports of like mercenaries and stuff coming over, and because it's a bit more stable than Sudan is at the moment. It's a wee bit more of a better prospect.
Oh, sorry. So mercenaries from Tigray going to Sudan?
Some from Sudan going to Ethiopia.
I mean, I know there is ongoing fighting, but the nature of the fighting has changed. And this is kind of an aspect of Abiy Ahmed that's kind of interesting. So he was celebrated for making peace with Eritrea. This was undermined somewhat when we figured out that he made peace with Eritrea so that he could crush Tigray. Now that Tigray is crushed with the help of Eritrea and some Amhara militias, he's apparently turned on Eritrea and the Amhara militias. So it's very messy, and it's entirely possible that after using this to crush the Tigrayans, we're going to go back to the old status quo of Eritrea and Ethiopian quasi-war, which is quite crazy. But I think it's important to emphasize that Abiy Ahmed has accomplished a lot here. He has not just managed to put himself in power, he has managed to significantly cut down people that used to run the country militarily. He has fundamentally shifted the way that politics work in Ethiopia. And that is kind of fascinating. And it is a sort of divide, can be looked at as a very Machiavellian divide and conquer strategy. The Tigrayans were tremendously powerful, so he used the Eritreans and the Amharans to knock them down, in the process chewing up a lot of Eritrean and Amharan resources. Now that the Tigrayans have been knocked down, I haven't seen much indicating that he's working with Tigrayans against the Amharans and the Eritreans, But he's definitely working against the Amhara and the Eritreans. So he's taking each of the, it's kind of Game of Thrones or what have you. He's sort of taking these powerful actors that were a threat to him, and the Tigrayans were the biggest threat to him, and they've been destroyed, and now he's going after smaller threats to him, like Eritrea and the Amhara.
Can you see this port deal with Somaliland going through?
Well, I think that is exactly where we should be moving next, because he's gotten to a point where he's resolved these problems enough in the west of his country that now he's looking east. It is a long-established goal of Ethiopia. This is why they fought so hard for Eritrea for so long, to have ports on the Red Sea.
Because they are famously landlocked when they could have so much potential.
Exactly.
So I think they get, basically everything comes in through Djibouti.
That seems to be, I believe they had built out a rail line or something, but I'm not really, that was just proposed. But yeah, Djibouti does a lot of their shipping. But Djibouti is a very savvy government that has managed to do deals with every military power in the world, it seems like, to preserve its independence. And Ethiopia does not have the degree of power that it wants. What it was able to do, I believe, on January 1st of this year, was sign a deal for the Berbera port in Somaliland.
Would you consider Somaliland the most country to not be a country?
And well, there's a lot of
potentials.
I feel like there's a fair amount of competition for that, though. Mm-hmm. None of them are really coming to mind. Somaliland is an interesting dynamic, as we've covered last week. Actually, Somalia has been in some degree of chaos for 30 years. Somaliland, which, and this is key, Somaliland was British, so there was already decades of division sort of baked in there. The poor Somalis, as I think if you've got the graph in front of you, Somalis are actually a significant minority within Ethiopia. Is that correct? A lot of Eastern Ethiopia is made up of ethnically Somali folks. I'm not sure what the...
6.5%. So, but that makes them the third largest in the country.
So more Somalis in Ethiopia than Tigrayans.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But still fairly close.
So famously in the 70s, with U.S. support against the communist dictatorship, the Somalis fought an aggressive war against Ethiopia that they lost. That is also a factor in its disintegration. So the Somalis are really, really angry about the prospect of losing Somali land, which in the 1990s, it had its own history of sort of independence from Somalia. Somalia was a mess. So starting from the 1990s, they started establishing the rudiments of self-government and attained a degree of peace that has rightly been seen as very impressive across the world. It has not, however, been recognized as independent. And Somalia is incredibly angry that Abiy Ahmed and Ethiopia think that they can sign this deal for essentially control of this port. I believe it is a 50-year lease for this port. And crucially, it is not just commercial. This would allow...
Oh, yeah, military.
This would allow Ethiopian naval assets to be established there. And that is something that Ethiopia desperately wants. It wants... And it makes a kind of sense. Djibouti and even Eritrea are not countries that are going to be able to afford a navy that is going to have any kind of impact. Ethiopia is a country of 120 million people with a GDP of $111 billion. It could have a real naval force.
And it's something that could only, you could only see it as helping their economy. So in 10 years, the naval force could be quite impressive.
Yep. Yep.
Because of the sheer amount getting a port, it contributes to the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't know the extent to which it would be dramatically better for them economically than the Djibouti access they already have, but it's another port. It is, and that in and of itself provides a tremendous amount of economic potential, strategic potential, what have you. There is a very real possibility of active fighting between Ethiopia and Somalia over this. And that is tremendously concerning. But I think we've already established that Abiy Ahmed is not somebody who's really going to be nervous about a fight. And also, this is not something that is a surprise to him. I think that the Ethiopian elites are very aware that Somalia is super happy with Ethiopia's already existing control over Somalia's. And they could have predicted that the reaction would be outsized. So it is an interesting strategic step by Ethiopia to simply say, well, and I think it's an interesting indicator of what Abiy Ahmed's feeling is, because this is, seems like a pretty conscious choice to pick another fairly sizable fight.
Can you see Somaliland getting one UN member state to recognize it now?
Well, I'm embarrassed I didn't look into this. Has Ethiopia recognized Somaliland? I don't think it has.
I think famously nobody does. Yeah, so that's what I mean. Yeah. Ethiopia might start to now.
I think that's part of the. I haven't read the Memorandum of Understanding, but my understanding is that there is some ambiguity there, and that's one of the possibilities that makes Somalia incredibly, incredibly angry.
So a Taiwan sort of situation?
Kind of, yes. It tremendously different, but it always does seem to involve coastlines, doesn't it? There is an aspect about this new conflict that Ethiopia has started in the east that might be seen as a way of diffusing conflict in the west. Abiy Ahmed has always, and I think the Ethiopian government has usually made it quite a priority to develop a port, to have a port of its very own. And by signing this deal, this does away with some of the speculation that Ethiopia was about to try to conquer Eritrea again. So maybe that.
So should this cheer up Eritrea?
Well, I think that's one of the arguments there, but I can't imagine it really would. It is just fascinating that Abiy Ahmed is able to do all of these things. And it's really hard to think of a sort of strongman or dictator really anywhere that is accomplishing as much as he seems to be. It remains a very open question. Is he going to be remembered as the father of his country, or is he going to end up stepping a little bit too far and igniting some kind of region-wide conflagration?
Well, could they be a Libya for the region, as in if they do get this port and start to become, you know, a thriving economy, could they have a positive effect on their neighbors and calming the region?
Well, they already have, to a degree. I mean, there has been a great deal of spillover prosperity for Djibouti, arguably, when Ethiopia is not invading Somalia, for Somalia and Somaliland. It has been up until 2020, or maybe a few years before, it was one of Africa's few great success stories, economically speaking. It is an interesting dynamic. Like, we are just thinking in the broader context of post-colonial Africa. It seems like most of these post-independence countries weren't given much by their imperial masters who left.
Generally, anything that wasn't nailed down was taken with their imperial masters.
Yeah, and then were instantly crippled by the oil crisis in 1973. Large-scale African independence didn't really get started until the 60s and, you know, limped on until the 1990s. That oil crisis crippled a lot of places. What I'm seeing with Abiy Ahmed that I find exciting or interesting, despite the frankly genocidal aspects of some of what he's been up to, like the real assertion of African power, frankly. And at this point, most of the victims of those exercises have been minorities within Ethiopia, or neighboring countries, you know, the very attractive like Somaliland and the very unattractive like Eritrea. But it is kind of interesting to see the birth of real African power. And it's a question, is like, is this like, what does this mean? Like, does this have to be like, you know, the kinds of state formation and power projection, like, does it have to be kind of genocidal? Is it inevitable that a figure of this magnitude is going to make changes that Africa might need?
Yes, it's going to be evil. It's going to be horrible.
Is going to be damaging and violent and destructive to an extent. I mean, is that sort of where we're at? I don't know. It's a very open question.
To tie it into the last episode we did, is this something America would want, which is theoretically, let's say this is successful and they're able to sort of secure the region and, you know, stop piracy altogether. Do you think the U.S. Navy would like that, or do they like the excuse of, oh, potentially something mad could happen, so give us some more billions, please?
Well, that's the tension. I think that absolutely the Navy wants something bad to happen and can get billions, please, but it can't admit that it wants that. So I think there is a real thirst for, like, especially in the context of chaos everywhere else in the region, there is, and this isn't just an Abiy Ahmed thing, this is Melisanawi did this when he invaded Somalia at the U.S.'s behest in 2006-2009. They like the idea of a powerful, the U.S. government at least, likes the idea of a powerful ally in the Horn of Africa that can be used for fun projects like destroying Somalia again. So especially in a region with as much chaos as it has, I feel like on balance, the United States would be, or China would be happy to have a new powerful group to work with. And it is kind of fascinating the way that the U.S. involvement in the Tigray War went. Ethiopia's government military seems to be very dependent on a lot of aid from Turkey and from the United Arab Emirates. And when his attempt against the Tigrayans was looking particularly genocidal, the United States put a lot of pressure on Turkey and the UAE to roll that support back. And then when it looked like his government, for a minute there, it looked like his government might actually fall and the TPLF was marching on the Ethiopian capital, all of a sudden, the UAE and Turkey were a lot more generous, and I don't think they would have been without some degree of U.S. okay there. Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the United States may be somewhat Abiy Ahmed curious, you know? And we've certainly established that genocide doesn't mean much to us recently, so yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible mm-hmm. to be reminded of that mm-hmm. horrendous situation. Mm-hmm. But could this be incredible for China? Because, you know, strategically, this is a great place for China to move goods into Africa. And if it does have a, you know, calming effect on the region, it could just be a lovely little gift for them. A nice port to move all their goods into.
Well, it's a gift. It's a gift for humanity. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be a China China bad thing. But yeah, I mean, China has economic interests in Africa. I think the extent to which they have strategic military interests in Africa has been really overstated. But to the extent that they do have military interests, I mean, is it still the only overseas Chinese base? Isn't there one in Cambodia? I think there's one in Cambodia now, or at least they're building one in Cambodia. China has a military base in Djibouti, right over the border from Ethiopia. So developments in Ethiopia do, if they do anywhere, developments in Ethiopia have some kind of military or strategic effect for China.
Apparently they have one in Cuba.
Oh, like a listening post? Like a listening post or something? Yeah, I don't know.
Tajikistan and Djibouti, so three.
And I'm sure there's some dispute over whether to call what they have in Cuba a military base.
Yeah, it's down as an espionage facility.
An espionage facility. Okay,
I love that, so that's like, just saying that on the top, like a normal
that's
shop.
That's like three guys and some signals equipment, I'd imagine.
No, just when I'm thinking about that silly Havana syndrome, when you have people with, what is it, the Was there medication they were given in like Desert Storm that was horrendously damaging to soldiers and they're not really getting any help?
There are a lot of scandals related to how
soldiers are treated.
Yeah. From Agent Orange in Vietnam to a number of, I think, weapons disposal facilities and issues in Iraq that I think have been tightly linked to serious cancers. I think even the president's son, Beau Biden, might have actually died because of something along those lines. Don't quote me on that. I'm not entirely certain about that.
But just quite often they're not eligible for help. And then you have this Havana syndrome, which a lot of people seem to think is not a real thing.
I think the CIA finally came out and said it was not a real thing.
It's possible you can get in a hysteria if like everyone thinks they have a thing and that you can get sort of nocebo'd into it. But beyond that, yeah.
Yeah. Havana syndrome, man.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we start talking about Havana syndrome?
Because we're talking about Chinese overseas bases.
Ah, yes. Yes, indeed. And Cuba, of course. Of course. But yeah, Havana syndrome, you sort of tend to get more respect for a bunch of Washington, D.C. pencil pushers and their perceived, frankly, imaginary medical issues than you do for...
Yes, but they're getting plenty of money to help with that.
Yeah, than you do for real medical issues experienced by soldiers on the ground, which is one of many injustices that we cover on this podcast.
But let's hope there's a lot less injustices coming from the Horn of Africa.
Here's hoping, Rory. Here's hoping.
And we'll catch you next time.
Awesome.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.